This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 1st of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
I'm Tyler Brûlé, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today has been responsible for some of the most innovative buildings in the world, from glass and steel structures like the Reichstag in Berlin and London's Gherkin, to design and engineering masterpieces like the Millau Viaduct in France and the work-in-progress Masdar City in the UAE. Lord Norman Foster has been the driving force and mind behind Foster & Partners for over 45 years. Born in Manchester in 1935, he graduated from the School of Architecture and City Planning in 1961. Just 7 years later, Foster Associates was born, and office blocks, transport hubs, and universities have not looked the same since. Lord Foster, thank you very much for joining us on The Big Interview. I thought that we should perhaps not focus on an individual project, but maybe we can sort of start in a macro view and sort of work our way in. I thought to just look at cities. So much attention, of course, given to the great migration that continues into major centers around the world. And when you travel from this continent, of course, we're sitting in Europe at the moment, and you make your way to Asia, back to North America, are you inspired by what you see on a leadership level when you talk to urban planners, if you have to talk to urban planners, when you look at the progress of the 21st century city today?
I find it exciting that those Asian economies, not just Asia, but the emerging so-called economies, have the kind of can-do spirit that typified our societies in the 19th century. And in a way, the idea of something being difficult is encouraging and a challenge. And so I find that incredibly stimulating. Of course, I still, like you, get a buzz from traveling here, there, and everywhere. And exciting things are happening everywhere. But the idea that if you don't have any land, but you have an island, it's a mountain, you knock it down, you spread the earth around, you don't have connections, so you build railways, bridges, and it's no big deal. Of course, it's an extraordinary achievement. But the attitude of mind, it is an attitude of mind. It's not about money. It's not about management. It's not about a political system. It's about attitude.
That can-do spirit. Do you feel that it has been the weight of, I guess on one side, a different type of political voice? I think the way that European Western societies have manifested themselves over the last three or four decades, that the can-do spirit has somehow just been, I think, beaten out of so many people, because when you're in Asia, there is this, not just a can-doism, there's just a get-on-with-it spirit. And I feel, and you're talking about sort of connectivity, and we can come to some major structures that maybe have not happened, you know, on this side of the world. And somehow I feel that, don't people see that we're kind of moving out of the game if we don't get on with it?
I agree totally. If you don't have a hub here in the UK where you can fly out to those emerging cities, if you have to go to Madrid to connect with Latin America, if you have to go to Amsterdam to connect with, you know, a growing Asian city, you'll lose out in the end. And I remember in Beijing visiting a site. It wasn't one of our sites, interestingly. It was another architect, but it was a European site manager. And he put it something like this. The conditions here are more dangerous than in Europe. They're much worse. But the workforce comes in and they're looking forward to tomorrow. They're looking forward to a future. They're optimistic. They're smiling. And I feel when I go home as if everybody's complaining. So here they're looking forward to a future. In Europe, they're looking back and whining. Now, this is not my observation. This is somebody who chose.
I think many would agree. Absolutely. Is it the role of politicians? Is it the role of the operators? And I don't care whether we're talking about airports in London or it's train stations that need to be built in Germany or whatever it is, that people are not willing, not ready to have an argument to say, if you don't get into the game, I think as we're saying, you're going to be out of the game. You will become at some point an emerging economy again.
I think it's okay if you really take that as a calculated decision. if you say, we don't want disruption, we don't want upheaval, we like it as it is, and we're happy to slide back, that's fine, as long as it's not drifting and saying one thing and actually doing another thing, which is hypocritical. So I think it does come down to political leadership, because in the end, the engineers, the architects, the teams who can implement, in the end, they cannot make the decisions. The only tool an architect or an engineer has is advocacy. Mm. So I can tell you why I think it's important that there is an investment in infrastructure, why it's important to think big. Of course, there's always the counter argument that, you know, it's arrogant, it's whatever. But to do the kind of things that we're doing in those emerging economies is hard work. It's really tough. It's not about, you know, grandiose visions. It's about confronting the reality of a world which is connected. Mm. And if you're not connected, you're not going to thrive.
Why don't we go to a city which is developed, but at the heart of the developing world? I think our listeners would be fascinated to hear about. You get a phone call, you're invited to, I believe it was probably a pitch process, if we go to Hong Kong when the airport was built there. You know, we now move to a third runway is coming up as well. What happens when you get a project of that scale? It's not been built before. The city, of course, wants to make its mark in the world. How much is your firm, how much are you leading the process to say, gentlemen, ladies, this is what we need to be building here, versus they say, we reckon we need 75 stands for the aircraft, the throughput of passengers is going to be X? Or are you also constantly challenging that as a firm as well, especially when it's something, I'm always just fascinated by these infrastructure projects.
Well, first of all, you're making huge sacrifices. You have to move quickly. I mean, when we did Beijing Airport, we had to mobilize and get a very, very large team into Beijing, into a hotel. The hotel was taken over. The other disciplines came. Everybody had to work through Christmas. March, 3 months later, we started on site with enough contract documentation to start the process running. And so it is being responsive and at the same time also bringing in experts to question and to challenge and to say, are you absolutely sure that your brief is right? It depends on the city. It depends on the economy. In some cases, they've done their homework to an extraordinary degree. The chances are they have experts who know every airport in the world, have analyzed it. In other cases, they need help, they need audit, they need cross-checking, questioning. So it's getting that balance between being an advocate, an audit, challenging, questioning, but at the same time, having that, sharing that can-do mentality. Mm. I remember on Beijing, all the major meetings with the airport board had been held in our hotel. When it was obvious that we were going to finish ahead of time, the last major meeting, we were called to have the dinner at the leader of the project at his place. And his place was the works canteen. And he had lived the project. This is a man called Commander Chen, and he lived the project there.
He was on site in a prefab hut or something.
He lived on the site. He didn't even take Chinese New Year to see his family during the duration of the project. He lived the project. And on the building site, there were these huge red banners. And on the way out, I asked the young man who interpreted, Eric, and I said something like, as we walked out, these banners in the canteen, they look like the banners on the building site in the building. And he said, yes. I said, what do they say? Well, on this side, it says, if you're afraid of death, you cannot be a member of the Communist Party. And I said, and what does it say on the other side? If you're a member of the airport team, you cannot be afraid of hardship. And we were the only survivors as architects on that project. And that, I believe, is because we shared that ethic. We lived the project 7 days, 24 hours.
on a project like that, when you think of the commander living on site, is there a certain ambition on his side, or is he living the ambition of the leadership, do you think?
It's very difficult to say. My own opinion, and it's only an opinion, is that it's seamless, that in between our visits, visits were made to that site at the highest level of authority, because words would come down about standards, about whether it was reflecting the right values. But there was, you know, there was a dialogue. And this individual lived the project and cared for the project, and so was concerned that the bathrooms were not high enough quality. They should be stone, shouldn't be plastic. I mean, this was, I felt it was seamless. Of course, it was tough. It was difficult. It's much more difficult in many ways than doing a project in, but they're extraordinary. I mean, that building was made there, apart from one or two specialist systems. That's a major transition. I mean, when we won the Hong Kong Bank project in 1979, everything was shipped in. Beijing Airport, everything, except the very specialized baggage systems, of which there are only one or two companies in the world, and they almost a monopoly. Mm-hmm. Everything else was made in China.
Tell me, when you embark on a large infrastructure project, let's stay with airports because you love aviation, I love aviation. Do you start with your team and the client as well? That there are three musts. And so if I think of, now I use Hong Kong a lot, I'm on Cathay a lot, I'm transiting through that airport constantly. And oftentimes we have a debate, Norman, inside this office, where, you know, are you more of a Singapore person? Do you like Singapore Airlines or Singapore Airport? And I always said, yeah, you know, efficient, all of those things, but there's something that doesn't really elevate you. And I think when you're in Hong Kong, there's just this incredible sense of space. But most importantly, I can see the aircraft. And I'm wondering, when you look at a project, do you get the red pen out, or you have to say to your colleagues, well, there's just some musts we have to do when we deliver an airport.
I think that story goes back some time. You have Norman Payne, who was the head of British Airports Authority, an engineer. At the point that we were commissioned for Stansted, he said, you know, I want a new generation airport. I want you to challenge everything. And we challenged everything. And we turned the conventional model of an airport literally upside down. Every airport terminal you walked in before Stansted, you looked up at the ceiling. It was all pipes, whirring machinery, solid ceiling. We put all that below the concourse and we opened up the roof to the sky, to the sun. And we opened up views, so we made an analog experience in a digital world. You could see the aircraft, you move towards the aircraft. That was revolutionary. Hong Kong, Beijing, the Mexico, they're all kind of evolutionary. Mexico probably is another revolutionary move because we increase the spans and we take away the flat roof and the vertical walls and we make one continuous kind of flowing membrane. And that's quite revolutionary because a typical span between columns in an airport pre-Mexico is probably 36 meters. Now we're 100, 170 meters.
What enables that now? I think people will be sort of scrambling to say, what forces and technology have allowed you to work with those types of spans?
I think
now?
It's the development of engineering skills, of being able to do many calculations, explore many options more quickly than in an analog past. And I think it's in the nature of design that you make from time to time revolutionary moves. But as a designer, then you're building on those moves, you're refining them. So it's a series of constant explorations and transfers of technology. I work with the European Space Agency, for example. Recently, the knowledge from that has enabled us to propose drone ports using drone technology, an emerging technology normally associated with, you know, violence and war, in this case for humanitarian delivery of vital medical supplies across Africa, because the infrastructure can't physically keep up with the growth. So in 2050, something like one in four of the global population will be African, and the population will double between now and 2050. It's 1.1 billion now, it will be 2.2 billion. And one third of Africa is within a so-called all-season road. And if you take an all-season road, it can be quite a quagmire. So I think that in that sense, the world of design is fascinating. You're getting major initiatives which are coming from these emerging economies and which will feed back also into our more established economies. But the question is, do we learn from that?
Well, you talk about this great march of humanity, looking at the African continent, but also, you know, the emerging economies right now, and Mexico being, you know, a fine example. I think your Mexico City project is amazing that this happens on the doorstep of the U.S. when all of us are wondering, you know, when someone is going to get the memo that, yeah, maybe three or four U.S. cities need a proper hub as well, a proper hub to serve the world. And I think it's politically fascinating that the Mexicans are doing this. But as a side note, do you think that when we look at sort of lessons learned and what has to occur in cities, you know, oftentimes everyone wants to talk about placemaking today. And so we erect a couple of towers, we put sort of plate glass at street level, and there's no interaction with the street. But I think about a project in New York when you worked with the Hearsts and that tower, where there was obviously something very interesting happening on top of something that was existing as well. And I'm wondering if what considerations went into that, because I think that's a very interesting project where it still relates on a very humane level, but also a very handsome level at street level. But then also what happens above is also a delight.
It's quite interesting. I mean, I was told there were certain things you could and could not do in New York. And one of them was so-called facadism, which when I asked about that, seemed to challenge every instinct that we had as designers, which was to bring life to the base of the building and to hollow it out so it became the equivalent of an internal piazza, and to keep shops and activities at the sidewalk pavement level. And we succeeded in doing that. And I think that it's proved to be a success in the public domain and also in the inner kind of private domain, where all these different magazines, which were little empires unto themselves, still retain that individuality, each having their own floor. But the collective at the base of the building is the common dining room, snacks, coffee, meeting, exhibitions, auditoria, and so on. But that is in the part conversion of a historic building, 1928 Art Deco, which was always going to have a tower, but it was never realized until we won the competition for that project. Interestingly, here in London, we're doing the same thing with Bloomberg. And on a site which was absolutely monolithic previously, we now make it quite porous, permeable. So we extend the line of Watling Street, the old Roman street, and that becomes an arcade in the tradition of past tradition of arcades. And the whole base of the building is alive with shops, bars, galleries, restaurants. So we are, in this instance, I mean, seeking to rediscover the qualities of the city, where normally, if you walk at pavement level, it's a blank facade. It's kind of hostile. It's not inviting. And handling security by involving artists. So, for example, Cristina Iglesias is doing water features, which are actually the barriers, the security barriers. And if you look around Parliament and you see how horrific security can actually, how intrusive it can be in the public domain. So seeking ways of humanizing those realities of security. So a lot of lessons of the traditional city being fed back. I'm often asked, you know, what are the most important things that you might have done in London? Everybody expects it might be the British Museum, and for very good reasons, or, you know, this building or that building. I'd say it was probably Trafalgar Square and the Millennium Bridge, because they brought a new quality of urban life back to the city.
Absolutely. Just on a project like the Bloomberg, their new headquarters for Europe in London, that type of solution where you talk about, you know, having this arcade and everything, and I've heard so many good stories about, you know, what will come in this building. Is that also those solutions are always down to the client, or sometimes can you be quite unilateral and just push through what you want? Maybe the client has the checkbook and they know it when they see it. Or do you think you really get the best solution when you have a good sparring partner?
There is absolutely no question. You get the best solution when you have a good client, somebody who cares and somebody who challenges and somebody who doesn't delegate it to some anonymous individual or committee. So Mike Bloomberg personally cares and is hands-on and right at the center of that project. And the project gathered momentum as we all worked together. So early in the process, there was enough confidence to explore how, in quite a deep building, which is about internal communication, open floor plans, unbroken space, how you can naturally ventilate that. And that is revolutionary, because naturally ventilating a space is normally a shallow space. To do that and to pull air through deep spaces and to work with nature to reduce energy, to still control noise levels, because so when you look at that facade, you're really looking at elements which protect you from the sun but give you views out and also breathe. They're the kind of gills of the building.
I was with Jonathan Ive recently on the West Coast and heard a few extraordinary snippets, and we didn't get over to the site in the interest of time, but of course you're working with also sounds like an extraordinary set of clients, or maybe it's one client, on Apple's new headquarters. And he was talking about some really remarkable elements, and I think we'd have to call them elements in terms of these pieces which are sort of being, will go into place to, of course, create this wonderful sort of circular object. It sounds like it's almost sort of necessary that you needed to do something new with a client like that, also to push architectural technology, or not really.
Oh, yes. But it's serving an end. So this very large building is in reality one small compact building, because if you take a site of 170 plus acres and you decide, instead of sprinkling it as a campus with lots and lots of buildings, 16, 20 buildings, covering it with tarmac and cars, so to make the decision instead to have one main building that enclosed a park within its circumference and was set in a landscape that evoked the past, because that area was the fruit bowl of America and Steve Jobs remembered it as citrus groves. And so to bring back citrus groves amongst other elements of a Californian landscape is really to create a building which is about sustaining creativity, which is at the core. I mean, design is at the core of Apple. So that project started one-to-one with Steve Jobs. And after his death, I think it's true to say, moved pretty seamlessly. I mean, he paved the way in terms of individuals. So that's been a very smooth transition. Johnny, also at the core of it, Tim Cook, extraordinarily supportive. And so it's, and again, that is a building that's working with the California climate. And the elements that you refer to, interestingly, have created three new industries, three new buildings around the world. So there is a new building in Beijing related to the glass and the coating. There is a new building in Germany near Munich. And there is a new building, all of these are new factories, in Sacramento. And this has created new industries out of a project which is entrepreneuring on quite a large scale.
I want to maybe end on the notion of making things. And before we went on air, we were talking about Vienna, and we were talking about a vehicle that needs restoring. I was talking about hats. Do you think we've moved into a sort of a curious place with cities, that cities, and maybe it's on this side of the world, cities need to be quiet and orderly, and they need to be secure, and they need to be places where maybe we make things on paper and we print them on the far side of the office, but to actually, to have proper output, and I'm not just talking about sort of 3D printing, but, you know, but people rolling their sleeves up and doing things, stitching together fabric, etc. Do we come back to that place? And is it necessary that we're able to sort of stimulate and create, you know, new industries in and around cities?
I think it would be incredible if we got away from the mindset that industry is dirty and polluting. Once upon a time it was, and there are still major elements of industry that are. But the reality is there are huge segments of industry which is about craft, rediscovering craft, quality, the nobility of making things, even in our electronic, virtual, real world, still needs the physicality of, you know, the equipment which we're both looking at here and the environment that we're in. So to be able to rediscover those qualities, to integrate them into a city so that the city is alive around the clock and not ghettoized into industrial outlying areas and cultural districts and so on. The city is, I think, the traditional qualities of the European city. We still have a tremendous amount to learn from that.
Do you think the European city is still the most aspirational? On one side, we can say yes, and we can laugh at Chinese developers who want to recreate a little bit of, the Danish countryside as a village. And at the same time, we can see, big U.S. projects as well.
I think the pedestrian-friendly European compact city is still an outstanding model of a city. But I suspect that the emerging technology of robotic machines, whether they're ground-based or whether they're airborne, and I talked earlier about the way in which drones can transform an emerging economy, Africa, for example, in terms of medical deliveries and supplies. I think the same may well prove to be true in terms of the robotic car. In other words, the suburbs could have a renaissance. So you could be looking at your screen on the morning drive to the office. Mm. You could increase the capacity of freeways by almost trains of cars, nose to tail. Of course, you also become more vulnerable to disruption electronically in terms of, cyber war and so on. But I think that technology has the power to question a lot of the assumptions about anti-car. In other words, if you change the nature of the car could be the friend, whereas at the moment, the car is the enemy and public transport is the savior. That's not in any way to denigrate the importance of public transport, and there has to be investment in that. But at the same time, I believe that the car could be completely reinvented, rather in the way that Silicon Valley has reinvented a lot of the things that we now take for granted but didn't exist a short time ago.
Finally, just before we go, if you could highlight two or three projects that will be very much in the public domain, will be accessible to travelers around the world, three things that are on the horizon over the next 18 months that will throw open their doors that you're most proud of?
I think that probably more than 18 months, but Mexico Airport will be kind of transformative experience. Bloomberg, although it will be have its private inner sanctum, will be very publicly accessible. Apple is a private world, but there'll be viewing galleries and so on. And smaller projects that don't hit the headlines. Maggie's Centre is more like a big house in Manchester, very kind of Scandinavian in many ways. It's landscaping, it's very gentle, but is arguably powerful force for influence and change in terms of caring for cancer patients.
Lord Foster, very good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tyler Brulé, in conversation with Sir Norman Foster. Tune in next week when Rob Bound will sit in this very chair speaking to British actor and prominent LGBT rights activist Ian McKellen. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luthi and researched by Gaia Lutz. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programs on Monocle 24. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.